good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, whichever the case may be on this rotating globe. Welcome to another live edition of The Other Side of Midnight, that magical time from dusk to dawn when anything can happen, including a kind of a how-to program tonight on how do you talk to an extraterrestrial. I mean, I'm really not kidding. For the last several weeks, we have been engaged in an extraordinary experiment, and we're now entering phase two, and I will give you some logistics and why we're going to be kind of going a bit out of sequence tonight. We're kind of jumping to the end of the show first, and we'll explain what we mean by that. People have literally bent their schedules. Some of them have not slept so they can be on the show tonight to participate in this really historic undertaking. And again, for all of you who are new to this, we will explain in great detail as we go through the next 3 hours. And I guarantee you it's worth sticking around. In fact, you may want to join our merry band, and we will discuss as we get later. Our radio with picture section, so you can kind of follow along with the videos, the links, the graphics, and the other things that we try to include as background for each show. What you want to do is click on tonight's banner at theothersideofmidnight.com. Tonight's banner says very forthrightly, Open Hailing Frequencies. That's the name of this project, Open Hailing Frequencies. Quick, three guesses where I stole that from. Talking to ancient extraterrestrials. Now, the operative phrase there is ancient, because, as I will explain in a few minutes, this is unfolding unlike anything that the standard mainstream SETI paradigm, SETI being an acronym standing for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, has ever taught anyone who's kind of looked at getting involved in this very arcane field, which gets back to, the title of my promo tonight, which is, how do you talk to an extraterrestrial? And before you all answer in unison very carefully, no, it has to be precisely. Otherwise, you will not get a response. It's not that you won't get a proper response. According to our data accumulated over the last month or so, unless you ask the right questions, you don't get any answers at all. And apparently, we started by asking the right questions, by sending the right transmissions, and now we can't get the damn radios to shut up, as we're going to talk about in some detail. So without further ado, if you click on tonight's banner for Saturday night, January 22nd, 2022, that will take you to the guest page. Right under the guest page, there are fast links. Click on my name. That will take you to our items. Item number one, the Webb Space Telescope, which we have been watching with an eagle eye for the last 2 weeks and change, is now fully deployed. The sail, the solar insulation, the tennis court-sized, huge, aluminized Kevlar blankets, all five of them that are going to shield the telescope from direct sunlight for the rest of its operative life. They've been deployed. The mirrors have been deployed, the secondary mirror, the primary mirror wings have been unfolded. They have now been able to raise the level of each of the 18 4-foot-wide hexagon mirrors, which are the subcomponents of the full 22-foot-wide main mirror, the main collector of energy for the Webb telescope. Those have now been raised 12.5 millimeters. If you wonder what rate, what size, what dimension 12.5 millimeters is, which is what they had to do by turning on the motors and moving them literally away from their launch lock position, it's about half the length of an ordinary paperclip. And they say in some of the documentation that's attached to the first link there, the web blog. They say that it took about a million, literally a million revolutions of these motors that will adjust the focus and the aiming and the tilt of all those sub-mirrors to make one final carefully aligned super mirror 22 feet across. It took them about a million revolutions operating over like 10 days for them to successfully get everything ready now for the fine adjustments that will turn this exquisite $10 billion piece of hardware into a $10 billion functioning telescope, unlike any ever manufactured, deployed, or utilized anywhere on Earth or off before. Item number two is a very useful website. It's basically where is the Webb telescope, and you can go to that. That will show you where it's being deployed at the L2 position. It will show you how much time is left before it gets there. It turns out it's Monday when they fire the rockets that will insert it gently into a what's called a halo orbit around the L2 point, which is a point about a million miles away from the sun, opposite the sun, over the night side of the Earth. But because it's in this halo orbit, which literally is larger than the Earth's moon's orbit around the Earth, that's how much distance there is out there, it will never go into eclipse. I think we touched on that maybe a couple of weekends ago as to why, if you're directly away from the sun, you're not going to get into permanent shadow. Well, the orbit is carefully aligned so it will never not see sunlight on the day side, and it will never see sunlight on the night side, which is on the dark side of those five tennis court-sized Kevlar Mylar shields. Moving on. We talked in the last couple of weeks about this bizarre event that happened near Tonga in the South Pacific. This extraordinary underwater volcano, which blew up. Well, it turns out if you click on item number three and four, they're kind of companions. Volcanologists are really, 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 really baffled by how this event unfolded, because apparently this was a once-in-a-lifetime eruption. I have not seen a megatonnage listed for the force of the explosion, but it's definitely in the nuclear weapons range, and it's from one volcano in the Southwest Pacific, which hadn't done anything for many, many years, and normally these things do not explode. They kind of erupt, and on the surface of the ocean, if they're underwater, you don't even know much of anything is going on. Well, as you can see from the image in item number four, there was a plume, a column of material, which because of the explosion was ejected to a height of 34 miles. That's up into the mesosphere, which is a realm of the Earth's atmosphere, which is very hard to probe because it's too high for aircraft, too low for satellites, and so getting material into it and sampling it is difficult scientifically. Well, this volcano, when it literally blew its top underwater, ejected a plume of material that went up into the mesosphere and sent shockwaves around the Earth, seismic shocks in the atmosphere, shockwaves like a blast wave from a nuclear detonation that apparently, according to the measurements that were done all over the planet, circled the Earth twice before falling below background so they could be detected. No, I mean, this was a huge, extraordinary event. And if you look carefully in item number three, which I think is the Wired story, the quoted geologists and geophysicists are basically baffled by the extraordinary strength of this eruption, which brings us to how it crosses what we're going to be talking about this evening, which is the reception of data from our Oumuamua radio transmission experiment and a brief, you know, weekend where we sent transmissions to the moon, because as part of our return signals, our return data, we got a set of numbers that David Sarita, who was our numbers man, has interpreted as the precise latitude of the Tonga explosion. And that was communicated to us 2 weeks, again, 2 weeks before the Tonga explosion erupted. Now, that's pretty weird. And that raises all kinds of profound questions, like how could someone who we believe is an extraterrestrial source pinpoint the location of this extraordinary, as the science folks are calling it, once-in-a-lifetime eruption weeks before the eruption occurs? Furthermore, why was the eruption at a precise geodetic latitude corresponding to the Royal Egyptian cubit as given to us in these radio transmissions in response to the Oumuamua experiment as decoded by David Sarita? Now, I'm not going to answer those questions. Those will come as part of our discussion in the next 3 hours and change. But they are very important questions, because are we dealing with two entities? One group, which basically artificially blew up Tonga, and another group that tried to warn us that this kind of technology would be used? Are we looking at one group that did this, and then just because they wanted to demonstrate their power and ability to transcend time, gave warning of what they were intending to do? Or is it even more interesting? And I'm voting for option number 3. And as we go through the program this morning, I will explain, and my colleagues, my other panelists, will describe how item number 3 fits into the overall matrix. I did not use that term accidentally, of what we're talking about and what we are trying to do. Item number 5. I mean, this is so weird. This is one of those things where it can't be anything else but what it looks like. A couple of days ago, one of my colleagues, and I have people all over the world who send me stuff constantly. Well, several people sent me news items, which is number 5. And the headline reads, NASA to Oumuamua, the new 22-year mission to this extraordinary object said to be an alien solar sail. Now, background. Oumuamua, which was the first known interstellar visitor in the history of modern science, acknowledged by the mainstream scientific community as extraterrestrial from beyond the solar system, interstellar, not a trapped member like a comet of our own solar system formation processes. This object came zipping through the solar system in late fall of 2017. 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, January 2022. There has not been really any normal, nominal, widespread public interest in Oumuamua for like 5 years. That's half a decade. And a little over a month ago, we began this rather remarkable Oumuamua communications experiment, where we beamed from a private radio facility in northern Arizona, 500,000 watts of radio energy and a set of coded signals repeatedly over the month of December in the direction of Oumuamua, which at the moment is 2.5 billion miles away from the sun, out there in the dark, totally invisible to any scientific instruments known on planet Earth, including the world's largest radio and or optical telescopes. So suddenly, a research group located in London, part of something called Project Lyra — remember, Oumuamua came to us at a steep angle, 33-degree angle, to the plane of the solar system from the direction of the constellation of Lyra. This group, Project Lyra, which has talked about right around the time of the first flyby of Oumuamua through the solar system, zip in, bend around the sun, zip out, never to return. They proposed sending an artificial probe to Oumuamua. And no one's heard any suggestions because everybody, every NASA mainstream source, all the aerospace contractors, everybody who's anybody in the field says it's impossible, essentially, to get to catch up and rendezvous with Oumuamua with any current rocket-based technology. End of discussion. So about a month or so into our experiment, out of nowhere, suddenly, a mainstream research group, which is connected loosely to the British research establishment, the military-industrial complex, and NASA, of course, suddenly is proposing a radical change in the idea of how to send, with current technology, a spacecraft on a one-way journey flyby of Oumuamua in 22 years if it's launched like in the next three or four. 22 years. I mean, that's as long as any interplanetary mission that NASA or any of the other space agencies have ever sent. And those were extended missions. Their primary missions were much, much shorter. Even the mission to Pluto, the New Horizons mission, only took 9 years for it to get there from launch to arrival, the flyby back in 2015. So one can legitimately ask, why is there suddenly this official interest in sending a probe to fly by Oumuamua, which for all intents and purposes is gone and forgotten by 99.9999% of the people on planet Earth? Could it be somehow connected with our radio experimental broadcasts, and much more important, the fact that we have actually received some astonishing answers to our transmissions, which of course is why we are here tonight. Now, in the next 2 weeks, on February 4th, on the morning of February 4th, British time, and about 8 o'clock in the morning, one of our colleagues, Maria Wheatley, is going to march into Stonehenge, move in certain organized patterns throughout the monument for about an hour, and will be attempting a transmission and reception and recording of everything of a handheld radio sending a second specifically designed set of coded information, which will be beamed repeatedly from Stonehenge, from this extraordinary ancient observatory that's thousands of years old, if it's a day. And the idea is that because it's a sacred site built with sacred geometry, and when I say sacred, you read that as a kind of a code for hyperdimensional physics, because all the sacred geometry is actually the measurements of the hyperdimensional physics model. What we're going to try to do is have Maria transmit and receive and record everything from Stonehenge as phase two of our Enterprise Mission ET communications experiment that we are calling, for obvious reasons, Open Hailing Frequencies. And as part of this experiment, we will have Enterprise Mission participants at several other selected ancient sacred sites around the planet, including, hopefully, Ayers Rock. And we will record everything, and in subsequent weeks, we will report the analysis of any data that we receive. Well, without further ado, I want to introduce a new team member, because we have been joined by a very interesting friend and colleague of this program, a guy named Dennis Stone, who, as you know, came to us from the wilds of New Hampshire, where he presides over a fascinating ancient sacred site that is called, iconically, America Stonehenge. And let me give you a little background, because I'm bringing Dennis on first as a new member of this global, you know, broadcast ET team, because he's got to catch a plane in a little over 3.5, something like 4 hours. So he's back east. It's the middle of the night. It's after midnight there. It's about 12:15. He has to leave where they are at about 3 o'clock. So we're going to good night him early. But I wanted him to, A, discuss with us the background of America's Stonehenge, why it's an appropriate title, the connections that he and his colleagues have now discovered connecting this ancient site of rocks and ruins and alignments and geometry and measurements with its ancient British counterpart, as well as to the Giza Plateau. So without further ado, Dennis is the president of America's Stonehenge. He graduated from Daniel Webster College in 1977 with a degree in aviation management and was a full-time commercial pilot for over 35 years. America's Stonehenge was opened to the public in 1958 by Dennis's father, Robert Stone. Dennis has been involved with America's Stonehenge for most of his life and has always had a fascination with archaeology and archaeoastronomy. And since retiring, yeah, right, Dennis has found many serpentine walls and spirit windows throughout the site, along with other extraordinary new discoveries. Dennis has taken numerous courses and traveled extensively to ancient sites, both in the U.S. and around the world. His family includes his wife, Pat, his son, Kelsey, his daughter-in-law, Catherine, and his hobbies, apart from trying to figure out who are we really on this earth, include traveling, boating, and classic cars. Oh, I've got a 57 Chevy I need to talk to Dennis about. Anyway, without further ado, Dennis Stone, welcome to a most extraordinary experiment.
Well, good evening, Richard. Thank you so much for having me on. And I'd like to say hi to all my teammates and to your audience. Thank you again. It's a pleasure, and I really appreciate you having me as part of your team. Thank you.
Well, we have been joined by a lot of people. You know, a radio friend of mine used to kind of compare, you know, doing a program like this to trying to herd frogs in a wheelbarrow, that they keep jumping in and jumping out. So we have a lot of new audience, which has jumped into the wheelbarrow. So we've got about 5 minutes to the bottom of the hour. Why don't you start by giving us some background? What the heck is something that I'm sure most of the audience has not heard about? What is America's Stonehenge?
Well, it's still a mystery to us, actually, and we've been doing research on it since the 1930s. That's when the archaeology began. And my dad got involved with it back in 1955. So it's been a kind of a family thing for actually going on 4 generations. They have a granddaughter. She's over there every day. She's about 16 months old. So and she has an interest in it, I think, already. But it's a complex of stone structures on a hill in southern New Hampshire, about 40 miles north of Boston, 20 miles from the ocean. And it's stone structures that are an enigma. We don't know who built these structures. We have an idea of the age of the structures, but it's not the only site. There's about 800 sites from Quebec, Canada, all the way down to Pennsylvania, and we're finding more and more. Basically, each day, new sites are reported. We think it's an ancient stone culture or stone building culture, and they're very knowledgeable about geometry and about astronomy. And we think the site is basically a ceremonial site. It may have been a place where people were buried, but we don't believe it was a place where people actually lived, not a domicile, but actually a place of watching the stars, the sun, the moon, and doing worshiping. And we have 57 alignments with the sun, the moon, and the stars, and that work began in 1965. So it's kind of an astronomical calendar, if you will. It may have been a burial site. There are certain chambers up there that are very, very similar to the ones found throughout Western Europe, and also others found in the Northeast, as I mentioned. So, you know, we still don't know the name of the people that built the site, of course. We think now it's a layering of cultures because we have dates going back a fire pit up near what we call the North Stone, and it goes back 7,400 years, so middle archaic time period.
Wow.
But most of the construction, we think took place about 4,000 years ago. So in Europe, it would be during the Neolithic going into the Bronze Age, and over here it would be in the Archaic going into the Woodland Period. But again, it's not the only site, but it is a Reader's Digest version, because on 110 acres, we have about every feature that you can find throughout the rest of the Northeast, actually. Serpentine walls, chambers, cairns, standing stones, plazas, courtyards. We have the whole thing all kind of condensed together on the hill. That's what makes it a little bit different than the rest of the other sites, which are scattered across the Northeast.
Does it have like circles and standing stones with geometric alignments?
They are. My dad did quite a bit of work on that in the 70s and 80s after we had a surveyor come in to actually survey the astronomical alignment starting in 1973. And there seems to be a geometry to the site. Lines drawn from certain important points come up with equilateral, isosceles, and Pythagorean triangles, actually. And then this complete circle that you can make a perfect circle that does go around and touches some of these points. I think I might have sent one of the pictures today to Keith. I'm not sure if I did. We were having some problems sending pictures today, but one of them was supposed to show the geometry of the site, and if it's not there, I do apologize. But there is a geometry to the site, too. So, it's a very sophisticated site, actually.
Well, the thing is so intriguing to me, and we basically got about 30 seconds till we have to cut off for a break, and we can obviously pick this up on the other side, is that it appears to be extraordinarily ancient as opposed to, the canonical wisdom, which was, it was built by, New England farmers clearing their fields of rocks and stuff like that.
Exactly. We have 12 carbon datings, so we have the oldest date on the main site is 4,000 years. Another date on the main site is 3,000 years. And then the third date is around 3,000 years. And then outside the main site, I mentioned the 7,400-year-old date. But we're also doing optically stimulated luminescence dating. And the dates so far, they only took four cores in their preliminary, and they were uncalibrated. And what we heard so far were the dates were pre-contact, so before Columbus. So farmers building our site and a lot of the other sites across the Northeast is probably not who did it. We think it's a prehistoric site for sure.
Wow. Okay. David, let's hold it there. My guest this morning, starting off, is Dennis Stone, who owns something in New Hampshire which is extraordinary and extraordinarily relevant to the big question tonight: how do you talk to ancient extraterrestrials? Because in our first Oumuamua contacts, they've been talking to us, not about themselves, unless they're related, but about us. They've in essence told us to look to our ancient history. And so we have, and we're bringing Dennis on board to use one of the radios and to learn how to record what he gets when we attempt on the 4th of February, with Maria running point there in the center of Stonehenge, we attempt to activate a network, a global network of ancient sites. And at some level, I'm just kind of wondering, was this why the network was built thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago in all these ancient cultures? In other words, are we fulfilling the intended purpose of the global ancient site network in and of itself? You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
With this great reset, you're looking at Mr. Globaloni's efforts to move everybody into a cashless society, which, like it or not, that's a one-way mirror, folks. Because at that point, you're not dealing with a currency. You're dealing with a corporate coupon. that they can adjust the value of at the push of a button, depending on whether or not you're good little boys and girls. And if you're getting into a system where all of the infrastructure of financial clearing is in the hands of the bankers, that's not a system you want to go into. You look at the West, and more importantly, if you look at what some people call the Anglosphere, the Western powers that are English-speaking, the United Kingdom, Canada, United States, and so on, I do think it's the case there. They're using a health crisis really to drive a political agenda, and the health crisis itself is largely blown way, way out of proportion to what's actually the case. If you look at what Mr. Globalone is up to, they are recreating slavery. And the thing that is unique about slavery is they now have the means of perfecting the capital, because now they can literally implant your body with the means to track you. It's not going to go away overnight, but there are already, I think, some hopeful signs of cracks beginning to appear in the edifice. This is Joseph P. Farrell, and for all the news the media doesn't like you to hear, tune in to the other side of the news.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, January 22nd, 2022. Is that enough 20s for you? My guests this morning are very numerous, and we will introduce them one at a time. I'm going to go back to Dennis to kind of bring us up to date on what he has measured, because not only are we apparently talking to, you know, occupants of interplanetary craft, how do we know that? Because the night of our first test transmission on December 4th of last year, seven spacecraft showed up right over the antenna, photobombed on the no-level night vision television camera that Jimmy Blanchett had set up to record activity, literally in the beam of the radio transmission between the radio telescope and Oumuamua, 2.5 billion miles away out there in the dark. So we got answers. We got radio responses and interplanetary craft from somewhere showed up.
We are your friends.
And that's, of course, what we're trying to determine. Who are we talking to? Is it ETs? Is it hyperdimensionals? Is it people who have crossed over? Seriously, there's some evidence that that could be part of this extraordinary new communication. And then, of course, you got the government, you know, through its various plausible deniability agencies like this group of British scientists, Project Lyra, suddenly proposing, after we transmit and receive from somewhere, an unmanned mission, a 22-year mission in 2022 to Oumuamua. I mean, come on, folks. Can it get any more interesting? Okay, so Dennis, you are back on stage. Tell us why the America Stonehenge seems to fit into this extraordinary ancient matrix of human history to which someone is repeatedly trying to direct our attention in the 21st century.
Boy, I don't know how to answer that question, but the site is definitely, it's there. You can visit it. You can see it. And it's, it is quite sophisticated. The more we do research on it, we're using LIDAR on it now and ground penetration radar on it, the more sophisticated that the site appears. And 10 years ago, my son, his name is Kelsey, you mentioned him earlier, he's an engineer right now. He's actually at Raytheon Corporation. He's been at a couple other different, like Geeka, which is Dean Kamen's company, but he's been an engineer like my dad was. And a lot of these engineers, even Dr. Alexander Tom, which we've talked about before, he was an engineer too. So a lot of these engineers are quite interested in these ancient sites. My dad definitely was one of them, and is my son. And he was using Google Earth, and he was looking at some of the astronomical alignments back in 2012, just taking the line and going across New England because there are other sites. And he was kind of see if they aligned, and this was done in the 70s with just maps, with old technology, and you had to actually go out and walk on these hills and valleys and see where these structures were. To today, Google Earth has made it a lot easier, actually. But he decided to take the summer solstice alignment that goes to the northeast, and he just took it across Maine and right across, I think, past Nova Scotia and right over the Atlantic Ocean. It just for kicks, basically. And he took it and ended up in southern England, basically. And as he got over southern England, he goes, well, that's kind of interesting. It seems to be near Stonehenge. We've taken him there a couple times to Stonehenge and some other European countries. And every time we go look at a megalithic site or whatever. We went to Malta with him and everything. So he has that. He does have that interest. And as he zoomed in down in the Salisbury Plain, he realized it was really close to Stonehenge, kept changing the scale, and all of a sudden Stonehenge appears. And that line went right through one of the trilithons.
Oh, my God, Dennis.
It's so cool, So he had to do it a couple times to make sure he wasn't in error, doing sure. it, And then he showed it to me. And this is about the time that show America Earth was being filmed. And one of our friends was a friend of Scott Walters. And Scott had already been to our site, actually, back in before the show ever came on, with his family from Minneapolis. But he got a hold of him, and let Scott know about this. And they changed their whole schedule of filming, and they came to our site and they filmed that. And after that, we actually looked at some of the other alignments. I mentioned there's 57 alignments of the sun, moon, and stars, and we started looking at some of the others, like what is a winter solstice sunset to the southwest coast. And that actually goes to the moon pyramid at Teotihuacan. And my dad and I were there about 40 years ago. We took, we went into Mexico a couple of times, and that's an amazing sight,
I'm getting chills because when I went to Teotihuacan with Robin to measure the physics with the axitron. Robin and I literally sat on the edge of the apex of the Pyramid of the Moon looking over the entire site. So if we had turned around and kind of looked over our left shoulder, way across the curve of the Earth's horizon, there you would have been. Ha!
Exactly. Yeah, wow. Superman vision or whatever. You would have seen us, so that was pretty exciting to us, but it was the moon pyramid there. And then we said, well, we'll try a couple other ones like the equinox sunset. And that one actually goes through Pueblo Bonito, the D-shaped, structure in Chaco
been
Canyon.
There,
which
been there, been there. Extraordinary
ago.
Site.
You know that?
Chaco Canyon.
Wonderful,
yes.
Amazing place.
Yes.
Beautiful, beautiful place.
Very resonant.
So you got
very resonant.
Yeah. It is. It's. We've been there. We just can't believe it. And the energy. It's just something about it. But then we said, okay, we've got three places. Let's try the Equinox Sunrise. And then went through the Canary Islands, and I didn't realize, you know, from my education and talking to a lot of people, that there are pyramids there, the kind of truncated pyramids. And the lion went right through those pyramids in the Canary Islands. And I don't know if you know L.A. Mazzulli. He's going to go over. He's invited me to go over there whenever it's safe again, you know, at C-19 to go visit.
Right.
He's got some project he wants to do there anyway, you know. So that was pretty cool. And then the, you know, then we looked at the August 1st, which is a cross quarter day, because we have the quarter days, summer, winter, spring, and fall. And then we have the cross quarter days, the days that actually are the beginning of each season in some ancient cultures, you know. And August 1st would be like the beginning of fall, end of summer, you know. And it has a Celtic name. I think it's called, Maria knows the names very well. We can ask her, but I think it's Lammas. But anyway, that alignment goes through the Giza Plateau, through the Great Pyramid.
Oh,
and I tried that several times to make sure.
Wow.
But any of you listeners want to check it, and just to double, we like to have this double, triple, you know, check, you know, like in flying, right? You got to be very careful, you know, and when you're doing these things, you're a carpenter, measure twice, cut once kind of thing. Because we don't want to make mistakes. But if anybody says, hey, Dennis, you know what? It doesn't work or whatever. Please let us know and see if we made any errors. But true south goes through Machu Picchu, too. And that's been our true south alignment. Not, we don't use magnetic, you know. Everything's true north, south, east, and west. And we have those cardinal points, too. For the equinox, actually, we don't only have the equinox. We have the megalithic equinox. And the megalithic equinox actually divides the year into four equal quarters, or divides it in half. They call it the mid-year divider. And it's 2 days different than the equinox. And if a farmer built a whole site, what would he care about setting up these monoliths to mark, you know, when you can divide the year into half, you know, or quarters, 91 point something days? If you use the equinox, because the Earth does not go around the sun in a circle. It's an ellipse, you know.
Right, right.
It's not – if you go from our equinox sunrise, which is true east, and it's about almost a 9-foot stone that's fallen, you would count something like the summer, like 93 days or something like that, and then back, and then 80-something days to winter solstice. So they actually have the equinox, and they have the mid-year, what they call a megalithic equinox at our site, too. So we have both. You know, it's a little more complex than people might first think about the site. And then
so hang on, we don't have a lot of time when you got to catch an airplane.
Oh, sure.
But
okay.
I mean, these measurements, if nothing else, together with the radiocarbon dating, prove that this is a North American site which was intimately connected to some of the major sites on a list that anybody, you know, being a tourist and interested in ancient history would kind of tick off as on their bucket list to visit on some kind of a tour. In other words, getting you involved in this experiment to see if they will talk to the radio in the New England site is not a side event. It should be a major insight into who we're talking to and what they're trying to tell us.
Yeah, because those sites are basically like UNESCO World Heritage sites, you know, the other ones, you know. They're, you know, very, very important sites for sure, you know. Somebody, I think they called us the Axis Mundi, I think it's called, like the middle. I forget, there's a name they were using on our site too, like the center, you know. Talking about sacred geometry of the world, you know, and energy. But Maria is much more versed in that. In fact, when she gets over to visit our site, her dad was at our site 40 years ago, I believe. She's going to give me some instruction and steer me in the right direction for research on that, you know. So I can't wait to get together with Maria. So hopefully next year or this year we can do that.
Super. Okay, let me kind of jump to the chase here. You have been doing LIDAR laser precision measurements of the America's Stonehenge site there in New Hampshire. What have you found? Because when I heard some numbers, you know, when we talked a day or so ago, I knew instantly that I had to connect you and David, because David crunches these numbers and the numbers are falling out of these radio responses. So there's an ancient network that someone is trying to call our attention to. So tell us about the LIDAR measurements of America's Stonehenge.
Okay, yeah, they started almost 2 years ago, and it's handheld LIDAR, and it measures down to about 1 centimeter, you know, compared to some of the other, we had some LIDAR from 10 years ago, it only I think it was 4 to 8 points per square meter. So it's very blurry. We blew up the pictures. You can hardly see the stone walls, and there are thousands of feet of stone walls surrounding the site. So this can measure down to about a centimeter. One thing we saw, and you can now go back and look at it, and you can get your measuring stick out and do it, is the courtyard, the plaza area, and the chambers themselves are not with 90-degree corners. They seem to be trapezoid floor plans to the structures. We were not aware of that. And the LIDAR, again, down to a centimeter, was pretty, very, very interesting to us. Even the groove on the sacrificial table is not rectangular. It's almost 9 inches shorter at the top than it is at the bottom. The measurements, however, do not really conform to imperial measurements of inches, feet, yards, so forth. Roscoe Whitney from MIT was doing measurements on the sites 84 years ago when it first began, actually almost 85 years ago in 1937. And we have all this data that he collected. He said whoever built the site either didn't know or give a damn about linear measurements, because he looked at the height, the width, and the depth of these structures, and he looked at imperial measurements, you know, and maybe whatever, some other measuring systems, and he says it does not conform to that. But he was not aware of the megalithic yard back in the 1930s. That's what Dr. Tom worked on, and I think in 1967 I have the publication that Dr. Tom and his son Dr. Archibald Tom put together about megalithic inch and megalithic yard, megalithic rod, and megalithic fathom. And in the 70s, when I built the diorama of the site, we were kind of already aware of Dr. Tom's work, and we went up to measure a few things so I could make my diorama more accurate. And he said, geez, you know, I think this might be a megalithic yard. We did it over and over again. I had a couple helpers, you know. Well, we didn't take it too far back in the 70s. But now with the LIDAR, we can actually really look at the site more closely and see if that was the standard unit of measurement. It's 2.73 feet approximately, about 32.64 inches. There is another measurement in Spain. It's ancient. It's called the Spanish Vera. It's 3268, so it's very, very close to that. So that is found in Europe. But a gentleman from Brigham Young University, Dr. Clark, and my friend Mark Eddy, he's my publicist from West Virginia near the Grave Creek Mound, he sent me some material. And Dr. Clark's been looking at measurements, too, in South America, in Mexico, and in some of the southern mounds in the United States. And he's coming up with a couple different measuring systems. One of them was based on 83 centimeters. So I converted that to inches, and it came out to 3264, which is pretty interesting. You know, I'm like, that's a megalithic yard. So other New England sites and sites in New York, because most of the sites are on the Hudson Valley, north of New York City, there's about 500 sites there. So that's probably the highest density of sites, and they are looking at that too, and they are using LIDAR, and it seems like the megalithic yard may be the standard unit of measure that was used here and elsewhere, other places in the world actually. So that's one of the things that the LIDAR, trapezoid shape, corbelling in the stone corners are not vertical, they're actually corbelled, they actually tilt in towards the roof, and the megalithic yard. So we're quite excited about that, but I think we got to do a lot more work on that right now.
Hmm. Okay, have I missed anything? Is there anything new that we should cover before we go to David?
Well, we will be getting the OSL results from Dr. Feathers. He's out at the University of Washington. He is actually retiring, so they gave him the lab use for one more year. He's done 22 places from here to Virginia, and those other places also are showing pre-contact or pre-Columbus dates on them. And he's going to put this in a journal, in a geological journal, I think in April. And in this summer, he's going to put it into an archaeological journal.
Now, what kind of dating is this?
It's called optically stimulated luminescence. It can actually date dirt or rock, and it basically tells you the last time that the dirt or rock saw the light of day. So if they build a chamber and there's a roof and the dirt comes on top of the roof, they try to get the dirt near the, you know, the roof slab on top or next to the wall. And they can either take rock, and it has to have a potassium feldspar or quartz in it. Now our rock, we got granite up here, and it's full of that. And then they go through a whole process, you know. And we had actually people from Brookhaven National Laboratory on this. We had 25 people, state archaeologists, about 24 people here the day, all day, taking just four cores. It took that long to take the cores. And then they take it back, they process it, they collected little dosimeters. They put little dosimeters that collect radioactivity for 1 year. They leave them in the holes where the cores were taken. And then they apply that to the date, and they come up with a calibrated date, and that's what we're waiting for now. We have raw dates, which are pre-Columbus, but we need the actual calibrated date, and we should be getting it, I think, in about 2 months. We should get the results.
Hmm. But with an uncalibrated date of 7,000 plus years, there's no way that's going to overlap with Columbus. Come on.
Right. It's not even close.
No, no.
And the other sites, New England, are showing that too. Yeah, they're showing pre-Columbus because that puts it back before the colonial, the farmers, as you mentioned earlier, being given credit or blame for building all these sites across the Northeast, including America's Stonehenge. The way the stones are shaped here, it was percussion flaking. Our Dr. Gary Hume, the state archaeologist, he's retired now, was a lithic specialist. And in 1980, he joined us and he did three projects. And one of them was looking at the way the big slabs were actually dressed or shaped using percussion flaking. And he said it's unmistakable. It's like you're dressing a gigantic arrowhead. It's not metal tools, it's stone tools, and it's Stone Age. It may have been during the Bronze Age. There are bronze pieces that Goodwin found back in the 1930s on our site. But these people were actually using stone against stone, I think, to dress these big stones.
So basically taking a big concrete ball and smashing it into another rock until it was shaped the way they wanted it.
They did, yes, absolutely, and on a big scale, you know, multi-ton scale, exactly. And Dr. David Stewart Smith was with us for 40 years, and he worked on British sites for 6 years for the pre-English Heritage group back in 72 to 77, joined us, and when he came back to the States, he's from Connecticut, he couldn't believe these structures existed over here, and he already been working on medieval castles restoration and on megalithic sites. And he was part of that whole thing with the way these big slabs were shaped using stone tools. And he had Dr. Gary Hume at the time, the state archaeologist, as I mentioned, oversee the whole thing. And we have that all on our 12-minute video that's on our website, actually.
Cool, cool. Well, your website, of course, is linked on the other side of midnight. Maria Wheatley is our archaeological expert as part of the, you know, she's the cutting edge of the sphere. For this experiment in Stonehenge in a couple weeks. She's also a dowser. She looks into the energies of these ancient monuments. We and I had a discussion a few days ago where she said the energies are rising, which means our timing is good. Maria, is there anything you want to ask Dennis about new measurements here on the North American continent?
Well, it's interesting, you know, with all the alignments, which that's what we would expect for one. Once you have an alignment at one ancient site, especially if it's an astronomical one, you're going to get these connections. That's what the ancients were up to. But more than that, and the important thing about ley lines is that they have a major ley has two serpentine currents entwined in it, which I've shown on your pictures, Avebury Henge. It has a ley line called the St. Michael line, discovered by John Michel back in the 60s, and it has two currents entwined in it. One is male and one is female. That's called a ley system that is far more powerful than just a ley line by itself. So Avebury Henge, where you've been to, Richard, that's associated with the St. Michael ley and the St. Michael earth current and the Mary earth current. They were given names back in the 80s. And what I discovered at America's Stonehenge was it's just like Avebury Henge. It has a female earth current associated with a major ley and a male. Now, you mentioned someone's going to be at Ayers Rock, Uluru in Australia, and that is on the Mary and Michael earth current.
Oh my
and
God.
And it represents, according to the work, yes, so it's connected to Avebury, not through a ley line, through the living sentient earth currents, Mary and Michael, that cross at Ayers Rock. Importantly, even more so than that, is on the world ley line grid system, if you will, when we look at the earth currents and not the leys, then Uluru represents the solar plexus chakra, whereas Mount Shasta represents the base chakra, according to the work of Robert Kuhn, which a lot of people look into. So it's much more than just lines; it's current.
Okay, let me ask a dumb question. What is the difference between an earth current and an earth ley line?
Right, okay. You have a straight line, a linear line that connects ancient sites to each other. It's a linear line, and that's a ley.
And how do you measure?
And ley in English. Well, you can use probes to get a DC current into the ground. If you want to measure a lay, you can look at the electromagnetic signals it emits. It's a straight line linking site after site, and Earth current meanders around it like the caduceus symbol. Imagine the caduceus symbol. You've got a straight line with two currents entwining it. That's a lay system.
Is this like a horizontal vortex?
Will meander.
Is it like two horizontal vortices?
No. It's like a straight line has two rivers entwining it, two currents moving in around it,
okay,
within about 10 miles either side of that line,
like
the
DNA
symbol, like a DNA strand.
Ah,
exactly.
Okay.
That's perfect.
Or a sine wave.
Adam reminds me of an XLR cable, a microphone cable.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, this is what we're looking into now more in England. We've gone beyond the lay, and now we're looking at lay systems and how these earth energies connect worldwide, because they seem to have stronger signals. And they also link every single site in a ceremonial landscape. So the lay will go through one part in a ceremonial site, like Dennis was explaining, America Stonehenge links to one of the trilithons. I'd be interested to know which one, because some of them have been reconstructed and some of them are in situ. But the earth current would target every single site in a ceremonial landscape. That's the difference.
Hmm. So is one of the other differences scale? In other words, would it be appropriate to compare earth currents to superhighways, the interstate highway system, and ley lines to more local traffic, smaller roads?
Well, both of them are important in their own right. So the lays connect worldwide, and
okay,
so the earth current. So they're kind of equal in strength, but the earth currents will target every single site within a ceremonial landscape, which I've shown in one of the pictures that I sent for your pictures with radio. I've given an example of the St. Michael Lay going through Avebury, and the Mary and Michael currents targeting the other sites there. So you can visually see what I mean.
Okay, we're coming up to the top of the hour, so let's kind of hold off on what we're going to do until the next couple, 3 minutes pass. What's so interesting about this, I mean, who is not interested in these ancient sites and the extraordinary architecture ranging from Stonehenge to Giza to Tiwanaku, to Teotihuacan, to, you know, the Easter Island statues, all those, something in my throat. But the idea that someone, in response to an extraterrestrial hail, specifically sends us back messaging, basically saying, look to your own ancient sites, that's where things get really, really interesting. Because, of course, in those sacred sites is our hidden ancient history, who we are really on this planet, what we're doing here, why some have tried to suppress our knowledge, our memories of that ancient history, and maybe how we can become what we used to be again. To be continued. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
If everything's ready, you're on the dark side of the moon. Play the five tones.
Back everyone to the other side of midnight on this Saturday, January 22nd, 2022. You know, it's so eerie because what we're basically getting from the responses to our tones that we sent into the cosmos beginning now several weeks ago, we're getting responses that are the same kind of tones that can be translated a la frequency analysis, spectrum analysis, and graphical analysis into mathematical constants and tones and geometry, which is built in to Earth's most ancient, sacred, fascinating, and mysterious history itself. Could this get any better?
Take everything from the last to her pattern notes of the one.
We have a translation interlock on their audio signal. We're taking over this conversation now.
And welcome back, everyone. No, I don't think we're going to hear that in response to Maria's transmissions on the morning of the 4th. But what we do hear, what we've heard so far, basically translates into a set of extraordinarily, deeply specific, meaningful numbers. So I want to go to our numbers guy, who is David Sarita. I'm going to give very shorthand introductions to all our panelists tonight because you can go to the other side of midnight. You can click on bios under the banner on the guest page. That will take you to lengthy background on each of these experts. So David has been working with sacred geometry, sacred frequencies, with tonal resonance, with the healing effects of these resonant frequencies for literally decades. And he's been kind of one of our key early translators of what was coming to us in the form of these radio transmissions. So without further ado, David, what have we learned in the last week?
Oh my God, I'm kind of dumbfounded. But first, when you look at Project Lyra, which was submitted on the 11th of January, which is well within our discovery time of, you know, being on your show and presenting everything to the world after the 24th, 25th, and 26th of December transmissions. Notice that Robert Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy III, is on the paper of the submission. And this, of course, is the mission to send a spacecraft back to Oumuamua because now they want to actually look at it. I find that very interesting. And Marshall Eubanks is also on the paper, and he's somebody who's been studying apparently natural radio signals on the southern hemisphere of the moon. So I think we're being listened to. I believe
you think?
We prompted this. Absolutely. Look at the time on. I mean, I've even got the guy's name who submitted this proposal, the scientific paper. So you have Adam Hybert, Andreas Hein, Marshall Eubanks, and Robert Kennedy III. Robert Kennedy III is only like 37 years old, and he's an actor of all things, or I don't know what the rest of, you know, his career was in, but he's probably obviously the son of Bobby Kennedy, the attorney, and brother to John F. Kennedy. I mean, the nephew. But because Bobby Kennedy was also assassinated. So I find this really remarkable. And I don't believe this is coincidental. I mean, it's coincidental.
How
I don't
can
believe
it not be part of what we're doing, given that nobody in the mainstream has given a thought to Oumuamua in years?
Yeah, and this paper gets submitted right on time, right in concert with when, you know, on your show, we've been exploring the data of the response from Oumuamua. And my theory is they probably tested it themselves and got some kind of a similar response.
Well, we published the type radio, the Baofeng
yep.
radio. We
yep,
published
we did.
The right frequencies. We told them just to listen and then record. We told them that you can probably record more easily acoustically than you can hardwire. This damn thing does not want to be recorded hardwire ever since our original transmissions back on the Christmas weekend. Again, it acts like it's an intelligent, irascible teenager. It doesn't want to do what you want it to do. But yeah, they probably tested it, got their own chirps, and said, oh my God, we got to go there.
And they're so slow that it's going to take them over 22
well, see, this
years
is,
to get
this is the
there.
Part that's so dumb, because I
yeah.
literally, until I put it, in a safety deposit box for safekeeping, I had a piece of technology sitting on my dining room table, which if I can get it funded, and I'm moving quietly to kind of do that, could literally take any mass spacecraft that NASA or the Russians or the Chinese or the Japanese or anybody, including us, would want to send to Oumuamua, instead of taking 22 years, it would take something like, you know, 2 or 3 months, literally 2 or 3 months. And instead of flying by at 12 miles per second, and there's not much you can do if you're flying by your target, which is very tiny, a few hundred feet across, at 12 miles per second, it literally could come to a dead stop, go into orbit, send a drone inside this object, if it is a spacecraft, hang out for weeks, send back television panoramas, sound acoustic analysis, radar measurements, magnetometer, all this good stuff, and it's literally current, if unknown, technology by the guys who put this cockamamie paper together, which is just nuts. It means they're not on the inner inside. They're on the outside looking in, trying with, you know, using a Spock quote, stone knives and bearskins to go out and find out if some interstellar civilization sent us a probe 5 years ago.
Exactly. No, exactly. So I want to also, should I go over my items?
Absolutely.
Now? Okay. So everyone, if you go to item one and
well, let's tell them how to get
I
there. Let's tell them how to get there. The other side of midnight.com. Click on the banner.
Yeah.
That will take you to the guest page. Under the guest page, you'll see fast links. Click on David. That will take you to his section of radio pictures. And then you'll be able to follow along.
Okay, so I'm talking about item one and two, and the reason I want to give this, because this is a safe example without exposing anything clandestine at this point, of how I get a location on the Earth on the radio. So you can see the image of my meter, and I'm actually replaying my capture of the frequencies when my radio is tuned to the frequency that a monopole at the height of the perfect royal cubit, which is 20.601 inches, is the most perfect royal cubit. I could argue that with anybody. It took me years to get that number. So you can see the number on my radio is actually 897.63. Now, if I take the square root of that, if I take the square root of that number, I get 29.960 north latitude. And that north latitude runs perfectly through the image on the right is called the panorama of the pyramids. And the little icon on that little image on the right is actually a pullout location where tourists take pictures of all three pyramids in this perfect alignment, known as the panorama of the pyramids.
Yeah, if you click on that satellite image looking down on the pyramids, it gets much bigger.
Yeah, it gets much bigger. So that little red icon at the bottom is where that north latitude appears, which means it's putting absolute importance on all three pyramids. And so there's a meaning to that. I've got a number of locations that came in on my radio. And we mentioned also last week that we got the alignment of the exact royal cubit, which is 20.601 south latitude, ran right through the Tonga explosion. Now, here's what's interesting about the Tonga explosion to get the intersecting, so you get your lat and long, right? So my longitudinal number for that location, okay, this gets really amazing. You're going to have to really listen to what I'm saying. If you go to my item number 3A, where Thomas Mathers gave us the digital peaks of the data that came in digitally through your radio, Richard,
mm-hmm.
We got peaks at 2.03 kilohertz, 3.28, all the way to 21.2 kilohertz, which is above human hearing. Now, when I'm recording audio off the speaker off my radio, I can't pick up numbers higher than 4 kilohertz. And in fact, I'm not even as high as 4 kilohertz. Now, I need to be between 4 and 6 kilohertz to get my longitudinal number to intersect with Tonga, and the speaker won't put that out. So what that tells me, because the speaker seems to stop below 4 kilohertz, and you can see from Thomas Mathers' data, when you record digitally, which was your idea, Richard, which is very brilliant, we have way more bands of resolution of numbers coming in, which means inside of those wave peaks are numbers that are accurate to multiple decimals if we could pull them out. So with
That's basically just a matter of the right software.
Yeah, because the message, the numbers we're getting on the radios are encrypted to the square root of 2 or the square root of 1 of your base number. It's a very simple form of encryption. If you read Simon Singh's book called The Code on Encryption, which I read years ago, this is one of many standard methods of encrypting numbers. And another reason you want to encrypt numbers is so that an amateur doesn't easily spot them. Right. So it's quite simple. It was very easy for me to figure out the encryption method. And again, I got the royal qubit squared twice, because now if you go to my item number 5, this is what's amazing about my item number 5 tonight is this is the second time at a different frequency, because my radio was tuned, this particular radio is tuned to the frequency of the perfect royal qubit. So if my antenna is 20.601 inches tall, its wavelength is 20.601 inches times 4, and the speed of light divided by that is 143.2 megahertz is where my radio was tuned to. I got right on the radio, it sent me back my royal qubit again, the square of the royal qubit.
Oh,
so if I,
my.
Do you see that?
So hang on.
So that means
hang on.
To the royal qubit, and they sent me the royal qubit.
I have to ask you another dumb question. We have been listening or transmitting only on two frequencies, 144.1 meg and 432 meg.
Yeah.
What this seems to imply is that in their responses, they are giving us responses on other frequencies, which are exact multiples of the constants they're trying to communicate, a la, you know, what's his name? What was the medium as the message guy? The Canadian.
The medium.
Yeah.
The medium is the...
Yeah, he basically coined the phrase, the medium is a message.
Oh, I'm not sure who that is.
Oh, Thomas, help me out here. I know it begins with an M. I hate these on-air memory lapses. Anyway.
Oh, sorry, I was on mute. Marshall McLuhan.
McLuhan, yes.
Oh, my God.
They are giving us in actual frequencies the data without the decoding necessary. So that's basically a spread spectrum response.
See, exactly, Richard. See, when at 144.1, I received 424.40, which is the square of 20.601, which is the perfect royal qubit. So that beckoned me to say they want me to listen at the frequency of a monopole whose height is
right.
The royal qubit. And then they sent me the 424.40.1201 again, which is, and again, that's just the first number. That's at the beginning of my recording session at that particular frequency that night. So that means we have double confirmation that it's not accidental. So this is the third frequency that they have transmitted. Mind you, we didn't do a transmission at that frequency. I received at that frequency actually only once. My radio has been dead quiet at that frequency for weeks, like dead quiet. So the reason that's also important, if you go to my item number 4, you'll see the El Castel Chichen Itza pyramid in the Mayan, in the Mayan Yucatan region. Its north latitude is within the range of accepted royal qubits between 20.61 to 20.83. You see, it's 20.682
is
the north latitude of Chichen Itza. So this is telling me they are giving us Earth coordinates, but what's going to be a challenge for us is going to my item number 3A, Thomas Mather's decoding from the digital recordings. We have multiple strata here. We have 9 strata of kilohertz bands that are, these are just your peaks. These are your peak waves, that there's data that we don't even know what it means yet. So each one of those stratas, you know, 21.2, 17.3, 14.8, all the way down, there's data in all of those. And my latitude longitudes are somewhere between the bottom, below 1 kilohertz, all the way to barely 3 kilohertz. So that's giving you an idea where I'm pulling my latitude and longitudes. But the longer number longitudes, if I square them, they're between 4 and 6 kilohertz. Now, my radio speaker doesn't seem to be putting out those numbers, but they are there because Thomas Mather's pulled that data out of your digital recording. So the data is there.
Okay, let me interrupt and say something that I think is really important. Science always begins in looking for patterns, mega meta patterns. You know, they call it metadata when the FBI takes your phone stuff for a reason. The big picture, okay? the big picture to me on this is when we sent transmissions, we were able to record. I was able to record digitally the responses directed to us, to the project. Mm-hmm. When we are not sending, they will not let you record digitally. I tried an experiment. I can record acoustically, but I don't have the right length cables and connectors and all that. Keith, we have to talk off the air so I can get that, you know, sent here. So I was unable to do any acoustic recording. What I think is going to happen, and this is why we need to all be on the same page with Maria's transmissions and everybody else recording in Bosnia, at Dennis's America Stonehenge, at the Washington Monument, in Florida, at the Mound Center, in some other place like Roll Right there in Britain. We need to arrange so we record the answers to our transmissions from Maria digitally. They will allow us, based on past experience, because they allowed me to digitally record Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and the day after Christmas, multiple times during the day, hours and hours and hours of digital recording. However, a week later, actually less than a week, when I tried to just record background, no way. They will not let anybody else record other than the response to their messages, implying we're tapping into some kind of faster-than-light galactic or intergalactic. Remember what Goran said? He thought we had a kind of a galactic internet here with the pyramids and the sacred sites. In other words, if we get answers to our messages, we can record it the way it should be. If we're just trying to eavesdrop, they won't let us.
Right. Exactly. So there's a meaning also we discussed last week between the ratio of my item 3-8 numbers, meaning that we saw the ratio of the Ark of the Covenant, which is 1.5 by 2.5 cubits. A ratio of 1.5 to 2.5 is 1 to infinite, 1 to 1.6666, which is an Archimedean infinity. So I converted all that to a sound file, which is my item 3. And if you play item 3, you can actually hear the musical presentation, kind of like a Close Encounters presentation like you played during the commercial, is
okay.
My item 3.
Okay, hang on.
My item 3 is an interpretation of 3A.
Let me try and see if it'll work, because it wouldn't work last week. You know, technology is getting very temperamental. I wonder if it's becoming conscious. Robin used to always say, just give it a rest. And I would say to her, what? Maybe she's right. Okay, what are we listening to? David?
You're listening to those numbers on Thomas's scale of wave peak.
Oh, on 3A. Oh.
You're listening to those. And in my years of tone testing, I've tone tested music scales galore, and some of them sound horrible. This sounds like a beautiful xylophone. They're very melodious compared to many even music scales I've tone tested.
What happens when you look for beat frequencies between them?
Well, there are frequencies between them. It's just that the peaks are at...
Oh, listen to this. It's like a hyperdimensional organ.
Yeah, so if I can, this is Thomas here, just to sort of clarify for people that are just tuning in. So those spikes, those individual spikes, were spikes that were contained within the chirps that were digitally recorded by Richard. And even though each one of the chirps had a different waveform, those were consistent spikes in each one of the chirps. So that's how I was able to identify them. And they were consistent at the same amplitude on each chirp. So even though each chirp was different than the previous one, they weren't repeating, it wasn't the exact same sound repeating, those spikes were contained within the waveform, and that's how I was able to get them. Now, the numbers that we got, and that's what David was alluding to, was basically kind of as precise as I could sort of get them with the software that I was using. So the next stage is going to be to get something potentially a little, that we can sort of zoom in a little bit more to see if we are, you know, bang on. So in last week's show, as I said, Richard, you know, I would say that this is probably about, you know, 98%, 98 to 99% accurate in terms of what the frequencies of those specific spikes were. But as David was just saying, I mean, it is pretty interesting that the spikes, when you isolate them into a tonal frequency, are creating that kind of a scale.
You guys
are
all masters of the understatement. Do you understand what you're listening to? Noise, thunderstorms, static on a radio, sitting in a parking lot trying to hear a, you know, a talk show. Does not sound like this. This is artificial. This is someone sending us a message, obviously an intelligent being at the other end of the radio.
You see, what happens, Richard, when you play tones that are not spaced harmonically, they wobble. They're like, like they're a mess. These tones, just one consecutively going from the first one, second one, third one, etc., are nice and smooth. There's no wobbling or distortion between them, which means they're melodic. I mean, you could do a keyboard and base it on these nine numbers and then add, I could turn this into a whole music skill, actually. I know how to do it. But it's kind of
reminds me. I was thinking of adding some lyrics.
Yeah, remember when the little boy is playing the xylophone, right? Everyone's going do 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 do. Like, you can take these and then you can actually play a little melody with all of these little notes here, because you don't have to go in a straight line. Like, what I'm demonstrating in the tones is a straight line, because I'm testing for distortion to see if there's distortion between the notes, if they're nice.
So we weren't crazy to, as part of phase one, to send Michael Hill's song, his music, coded with A at 432 into interstellar space.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, when we get into what the subsequent transmission is going to look like, I mean, as you see, I mean, we're sort of, you know, taking some of the responses and what is being received, and we're now grossly expanding upon that.
Okay,
and
this may be what in radio we term a natural segue. David, have you reached a kind of a stopping point for a few minutes so we can bring Thomas on to describe what he's been up to?
Yeah, I reached a stopping point. The only point I want to make is going back to my item one, the sample that I'm giving you of how they're sending me locations. I have several locations in southern Egypt. I'm just telling you that I'm not going to give you those. I also, in this same transmission, got the location of dead center Mexico City for some reason. And I wouldn't give out that location because it's so accurate, it would give you a...
We don't want the bad guys to scoop it.
Yeah, exactly.
Zip in there,
so
yeah.
This is a safe example of what it looks like, item one. And that is a location they gave me, by the way, on the radio. It's just that there's a profundity to it because you're looking at what's known as the panorama of the pyramid. So there must
okay,
be some
okay.
reason
hold it, hold
they
it.
Gave you that.
We're at the bottom of the hour. Ah. Time does fly when we're doing this. Brand new information, amazing tones. I mean, was this what Kepler referred to when he talked about the music of the spheres? And it's only going to get better with your help. And how you can help, well, that's going to be the rest of the program. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. Thank you.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Welcome back, everyone, to this Saturday night, The Other Side of Midnight. My guests, too numerous to mention, but David is going to take a deep breath. I mean, this is astonishing. You know, Dennis, aren't you glad you stayed up? Have we lost Dennis?
Good evening. There I'm still here. I'm half asleep. Thank you.
Well, this is what you might be getting. And what we're going to do is we're going to talk in a little while about technically how we can record the answers to Maria's transmission from Stonehenge digitally.
Richard?
Yes, Ron. Ron Gerbron is
Can I stick? Yeah, I've been listening. Can I stick a word in there? I thought that all that music, and I'm including the stuff from Close Encounters as well, was reminding me of something, and I realized what it was. It's Rossini, early 19th century opera guy, thieving magpie, La Gazza Ladra, the thieving magpie, William Tell Overture, Barber of Seville. It sounds like the music there. I'm wondering. Early 19th century, that rings a bell about something. But send him some of that music. it's in the same register and so forth. I think it's even in the same key. I'm never good about that. But anyway, that's it. And I had a random thought of when you were talking about ley lines and earth currents. Maybe you could compare ley lines to roads. And the currents to rivers, because rivers can indeed meander, roads don't.
Maria, what do you think?
Separate. Does that seem fair?
Maria?
Yes, I did say they were like rivers. Yes, hi.
Hi there.
Yes, I did say they were. Hi there. Yeah, I did say they were like rivers. If you have a straight line and the currents meander, they can be very wide, and some earth currents can be very narrow, like underground, comparing them to streams and rivers. You have mighty arteries and smaller veins.
How interesting.
Yeah, and they're subject to whatever the earth itself is doing at the time as well. You know, they can be pushed, because they can be pushed around. Or shaped, possibly, if we're not good enough to do that yet.
No, not really.
Really?
Because when we look at the Neolithic placement of some of the major sites, it's almost like the acupuncture needle. They don't move because they've been there for thousands and thousands of years. Some Mesolithic posts go back 10,000 years in this country, and they're on currents as well. So they seem to have some kind of permanence rather than movement, probably through the action of the stone.
I would also point out that if these are based on the physics, the hyperdimensional physics, which is key to the rotation and the orientation and huge inertia of the Earth, moment of inertia, they should be very stable.
That's what we think over here, that they are stable.
Exactly.
And, yes.
Okay, so...
Could we cover sometime on the show, Richard, how I actually do transmit from Stonehenge? Because
I don't know how to do that. We have found one little wrinkle that we can't do it live on the air, and there's technical reasons why we can't, but we're going to do it in the after party, okay? And we're going to create documents and a video that will get to you in the next couple of days that will lead you into obvious ways to do this. It's really incredibly simple. It's literally plug and play.
Fantastic.
You've got all your the things you need, which is a phone, basically a patch cord. You'll download the actual signal. You know, you'll mechanically handle the radio by plugging one cord into the radio and the other cord into how you're going to cord everything. And it's all basically off the shelf. And you will have a little Bible for how to do that. I want to go to Thomas because Thomas is an Emmy-nominated music producer.
Grammy-nominated.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Did I say? Well, come on. An Emmy is out there somewhere for you someday. Grammy, yes. Big, RCA megaphone. And he's a musician. He's been well-schooled in this sacred geometry and sacred frequencies for decades by predilection, by interest, by maybe intention coming into incarnation from somewhere else. I mean, we have to think about all this stuff now. So he's been very busy doing analyses for the last week, and tonight we're going to unveil the next phase of what he has found in what we have recorded so far.
So not so much what we've found. I mean, what I've been busy this past week is actually taking a look at what it is that we're going to be transmitting this next time.
But that's going to be based on what we found in part, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
okay, good.
I mean, what I had mentioned last week was that I thought it was important for us to be able to resend what we've received. So I've actually, I mean, if people that are able to follow on the website through my items, I've got sort of a few images, and I'll sort of, you know, go through and explain the rationale behind this. So fundamentally, I wanted to be able to encode through sort of more simple tones, very important numbers mathematically. I think that math is sort of a language of the universe, and it would be important for us to be able to sort of send signals out that are going to refer to, you know, special ratios, whether it be the phi ratio, pi, or different things like that. Now, yes, I'm a musician. I've been into all sorts of esoteric subjects for decades at this point. Math is something that I'm not a professional mathematician. So when we were,
but all music is mathematical.
Oh, of course, but I do, you know, a lot of the music I've been done, even though I've had classical training, I've been very fortunate that this is something that's just been ingrained into my DNA. Music has been something that's come very naturally for me, and I do feel that when I am writing music, that I am sort of acting as like a conduit to something else. The music writing process has always been, you know, a very mystical sort of process through all of the stuff that I've done over the years. And I started learning music when I was 5 years old. So, I mean, we're talking about 35 plus years of working with music. So, Because of that, I was feeling a little bit, I was a little daunting to kind of figure out how I would be able to undertake.
How do you
encoding.
Talk to an ET? Yes.
Exactly. So in last week's episode, in this sort of open dialogue and conversation, I was reminded by a video.
And we do not know who's listening, but the indications are that some very interesting people are listening, because suddenly we're galloping off to Oumuamua in only 22 years. Come on, guys. 22 years? Are they serious?
So in our conversation, I was reminded of a video that I had seen about 7 years ago by a gentleman who, I want to get this correct, a gentleman whose name was Alan Green. And Alan Green had decoded the work of William Shakespeare, and he had done an analysis of the cover of Shakespeare's sonnets. And, you know, upon first sort of look of this, and I've included in the items a picture of the cover page so that people can see what we're talking about here. It looks like a run-of-the-mill sort of cover of a book. So Shakespeare sonnets, never before imprinted. There's two lines, At London by G. Eld for T.T. and Are to be Fold by William Apley, 1609. That's all that's on there with some artwork at the very top. Now, this gentleman, the story is that he was able to go and actually take a look at the original copy of this to do these measurements. But if you take a look at the actual writing, there are some interesting sort of differences between some of the letters, and some of the T's had different sort of swirls or were pointing in different directions. And what they did was basically create a roadmap of where to be connecting these lines and these dots. And when you do this, and I really recommend people, it's only a 13-minute video. I really recommend it. So again, this is Alan Green decoding mathematically the cover of Shakespeare's sonnets, encoded into basically what amounts to two lines and a series of dots are like over 10 different extremely important mathematical constants, ratios, and equations. And it builds up to sort of the grand finale, which is encoded into this, is actually the latitude and longitude of the Pyramid of Giza. Now, this simplifies.
Oh my God!
So this simplified things for me, because a lot of these are being done through measurements, and it's measurements, drawing triangles, and the video very much. I can't even begin to explain, you know, how, you know, the mechanics of this. But I mean, it's very visual. They show you where you're drawing the lines, the measurements, and then the divisions, and then these constants. So, in terms of constructing the next signal that goes out, and I've broken this down. There's a PDF that's linked on my items, and you can go and take a look at this. So all of this is written down. So there's different. I've constructed the signal into a couple of different parts. So the first part is that we're resending the original chirps that were digitally recorded through Richard. So I've just taken a section. This is the section, one of the sections that I use to analyze and figure out those different frequency spikes that David then converted over to tones and turned into that sort of sequence that we just listened to. So part one was the resending of the chirps. Part two was actually taking a section of what David had put together to send that out as well, to basically sort of indicate, hey, you know, we've seen these little spikes. This is what the spikes kind of take a look, sound like. And so we're resending that. The third part of the signal that we're sending out is a frequency sweep of the human audible range. So we're basically, I'm using this as kind of like a map to sort of say, hey, these are the ranges that we can listen to, which is 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. So we're sort of saying, hey, here. And then I thought it was also important for us to send off frequencies that were related to our chakras, which is something that, you know, a lot of people, you know, will meditate to. So we're constantly sending a tone of 432 hertz, which is the root chakra, 480 hertz, which is the sacral chakra, 528 hertz, which is the solar plexus chakra, 594 hertz, which is the heart chakra, 672 hertz, which is the throat chakra, 720 hertz, which is the third eye chakra, and 768 hertz, which is the crown chakra. And again, these relate back to sacred frequencies as well. And then we get into the meat.
Hang on. There are seven... Yep. There are seven chakras, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. In the hyperdimensional model, which mm-hmm. is based on the tetrahedron, 19.5, all that, mm-hmm. there are seven and seven only symmetry spins in three dimensions of a tetrahedron.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So leading from those that sequence of signals, now we get into the meat of it, which are the mathematical encodings. And this is basically stuff that's related to geometry, which is the measuring of the Earth. David, this week has sent me a few numbers related to the Royal Cubit. So we are doing a there's two frequencies that we're sending out, the Royal Cubit, and then I believe it was the Royal Cubit. Let me just double check. I'll have to just confirm what this. Oh yeah, here you go. The second number will have to clarify what it was, but it was based off of an email that I got from David. And then we go into these mathematical constants and numbers that were extracted from the cover of this Shakespeare sort of decode. Now, the reason why I liked this is that most of the numbers were all four digits. So, for example, in the measurements, they go to display the golden ratio, for example, they're going 22.73 divided by 14.05. So these are measurements of different sort of triangles and circular things off of the cover of the Shakespeare sonnets, and you get the 1.618. So what I've done is I've basically just shifted, because we're talking about ratios here, I've basically just shifted the decimal points over so that we can get this into an audible signal range. So for the golden ratio, we're doing 2273 hertz over 1405 hertz, which gets 1618 hertz. And this is related, it's got a connection to the Fibonacci. This was a number that was discovered in 300 BC. A lot of these mathematical constants really seem to be coming from the Pythagoreans. And there's a whole, school of thought as to Shakespeare's connection to the Pythagoreans. But, this is why I thought that these were very interesting numbers that were, it made it quite a bit easier to be able to take some very important numbers in mathematics and be able to encode these using sound frequencies. So the next frequency is phi minus one. So we did 1405 hertz over 2273 hertz, which gives us 0.618, which is 618 hertz is what we're broadcasting, and that's your phi minus one constant. Then we go over to pi. So we did, again, I'll just give the hertz. Just know that all of the decimal points have been moved over to, so that we can get the hertz into an audible range. So we've got 3595 hertz over 1144 hertz, which gives us our 3.142 or 3142 hertz. And pi was obviously discovered by Archimedes in 287 BC. Then we go to the E constant. So your phi, your pi, and your E constant in mathematics are just absolutely massive. So, I mean, I thought that we would sort of start off like the meat of the mathematical component to the signal with those. So we've got the E constant, 3539 hertz over 1302 hertz. So you sort of get the process that was used here. I won't go through every single one. Everything is in the PDF for people to be able to see. So we're going the E constant, the E minus one constant, the Brun's constant. Brun's constant is sort of important in twin primes. It's important in that constant is very important in encryption and in internet security. And that constant was actually only discovered in 1919. But oddly enough, that was encoded into this document, the cover of this Shakespeare sonnets in like the 1500s or 1600s. We're also encoding the square root of 3, which was a very sacred number to the Pythagoreans because it sort of represented the Holy Trinity to them. The Euler gamma constant. So this constant is as important as E and pi. It's used in probability. It's used in music and prime numbers, and that was discovered in 1734. And then the sequence concludes with the coordinates of the Great Pyramid, which again was encoded into the was the last sort of thing encoded into the cover of that the Shakespeare sonnets. So we've got a latitude and longitude of 29.9797 north, latitude east 31.1299. So I've had to average this a little bit, so it's going to be close the tones that I'm generating are sine waves. So it's again sort of a similar shape as your helix in the DNA. And the software that I used to generate the tones was only going down to one decimal. So I could go 299.8 hertz and 311.3 hertz. And then what I did is I doubled that up. So I said 299 hertz and 311. And then I did 2,997.9 hertz and 3,112.9 hertz. And then I overlapped both of those. So that basically is the substance of the signal that we're going to be sending out. There may be some revisions before we do it, but I've included a link so that you can play it from start to finish. I don't know if you want to try to play that SoundCloud.
Is that number one, the SoundCloud?
Yes, okay. Exactly. Yes,
so let me try to play it. This is what, if you're a friendly ET out there, this is what you might hear.
So this is the original chirp. That was David, taken from my spikes. That's the frequency sweep of 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz.
Marie, you're going to make Stonehenge ring like a bell.
Those were the chakra frequencies.
Okay, well, you guys get the idea. And
exactly. So
and
all
the
those
cutlery
the
on the background is noise.
I know, but it's important because those are the specific oscillating hertz of the specific tones. So I mean, again, we're trying to convey a number through a sound frequency. So that's basically sort of goes on through the different constants that I outlined there, and then ends with the coordinates to the Pyramid of Giza. But this allows us to kind of understand exactly what it is we're sort of broadcasting out there, and I'm open to any suggestions or recommendations of anything that you would want to add. I think it's important that we sort of just from a time perspective, because Maria is on a tight schedule in terms of the hour that she's got at the site.
How long is that whole track? Have you timed it?
The whole track is 3 minutes and 30 seconds.
Oh, so that's how long it'll take her. And maybe she does it three times or so.
Exactly. So the idea was to try to keep this under 5 minutes.
No, that's perfect. I think it's great that you put all the numbers from Shakespeare's sonnet, because every single one of those numbers and ratio remains the same. So if you move all of your numbers up an equal amount, it can be any amount, actually, your ratio is preserved. It's just amazing how ratio works that way.
Exactly.
Like I could take all the base numbers times 1.234969, and if every single number goes up that same amount, then the ratio between them is always the same. It's really amazing.
Well, and the nice thing is that these all kind of work within an audible range. Now, it's not the most melodic music creation I've ever done, but again, we're trying to convey mathematics.
Well, you're speaking in the language of tone. It's literally a tonal language, and knowing what each one of those numbers means, I mean, it's going to be what's going to be amazing is what they send back.
And what they send back that resonates through the global sacred site network. That's why having Sam participate and Dennis and Michael and Maria's colleague there, I think you're putting them over at Roll Right. Am I correct?
Yes, they'll be at Rollwright, the Rollwright Ring in Oxfordshire.
How far is that from Stonehenge?
From Stonehenge, probably about 2 hours drive away.
Okay, so it's like 100 and some miles.
Yeah, it is. It's probably about 80, yes.
And is there a lay or a energy current connection?
Yes, Rollwright is on a bit of a there's a lay that connects Stonehenge to Rollwright, but Rollwright has also got its own earth currents, and it's associated to a ley line called the Belinus line, and the earth currents are called Ellen and Belinus. So it's got some very strong earth currents and a ley associated to it as well.
Okay, we are at the top of the hour. It's amazing how time is flying this morning. My guests are too numerous to mention. You can go to the website and you will find out who they are. It just seems to me that, there's an old apocryphal story that Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, was reputed to once have said, when it's steamboat time, you steam. Well, it seems to me it's time to put a message, a hyperdimensional message, to whomever we are talking to out there on the hyperdimensional river, which is in fact the ley lines and energy currents that connect these sacred sites all over the planet. And that, of course, brings to mind something like this. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
Someday, oh dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way. To drifters off to see the world, there's such a lot of world to see. We're after the same rainbows and waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend.
OtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Back, everyone, to the other side of midnight. It's the witching hour here in the land of enchantment. You're on the other side of midnight. It is now Sunday morning here in New Mexico. And what we're going to do tomorrow night as the other side of midnight plays, is we're going to replay in its entirety tonight's show, because there will be, in the remaining hour, specific instructions for how you can participate in what we're trying to do, even if you're not at a sacred site, because we need some controls, like if you're in downtown New York, or you're in Chicago, or you're in Podunk, you know, Arizona, or someplace. If you can get a Baofeng radio and you can follow the instructions we're going to talk about in the next hour, you can participate. And we're going to put the instructions on the website so you can download it. And then what we'll do is provide a common clearinghouse where you can send your recordings. Because without recording this, it's kind of useless. It's pointless. So you will send your recordings or a connection. We prefer you send them directly, that you not put them on YouTube, because YouTube does compression and distortion, and you don't want to put stuff on YouTube. What you want to do is you want to send it to us directly, and we'll provide you a site so you can do that. As many can play, who can listen to what's going on, as possible, because we're only going to have initially in that first hour, actually a little less than an hour. I'm going to bring Thomas in here to kind of describe what we're going to have Maria do. And then we're going to have overlapping transmissions with Sam and his people in Bosnia. And we may extend this to another site in England. And we have to consult with Maria live on the air. So what I'd like to do now, before we get into all those really nitty-gritty, geeky kind of details, I want to turn the microphone over to Jonathan, who has been doing also elegant work. Jonathan is a musician. He is a brilliant expert at graphic and three-dimensional video analysis. He has put these images, these sounds, through certain algorithms and files, and discovered some most remarkable new data. And so I want to turn the microphone over to John. What do you got for us this week?
Well, I don't have anything for us this week, Richard. It was not a good week. So my items, I just put up some images that are related to our current work, and my writing, I guess, because I've written several novels, and item one is a graphic I did for my novel Ram I Am. And it's in reference to a scene where Ram is thrown back in time to ancient Egypt, to a past life. And item two is some of my 3D artwork that depicts a battle scene from the same book, and that takes place in Washington, D.C. And we've been talking about the Washington Monument, and actually the monument gets cracked during this battle. So then number three is another graphic, the cover of the sequel to Ram I Am. It's called The Dolphinius Effect. I'm writing it now. I put my writing on hold 6-8 years ago, and I was writing the end of Ram I Am, and I'd written the opening sequence of The Dolphinius Effect, and then I just had to put my writing on the back burner to take care of some other things. And so it's nice that I've begun writing Dolphinius Effect again. The dolphins are very much on my mind these days. And so when, you know, the Oumuamua signals came up, I'm thinking, hey, dolphins, they're included in this somehow. I'm not sure how. And item four is just the cover flat for the hard cover there. And item five is another graphic. The Dolphinius cover art and this poster were done by one of my graphic artists at Charles River Press. His name's Rick Turillo, and he's a wonderful graphic designer who I've learned from over the years. And so that's just kind of where I'm at. I'm working on some analytics regarding the December 4th chirps that you recorded, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
And dolphin chirps from different, I'm recording from a different, couple of different species. There are many species of dolphins and whales, as you know. And so I'm comparing these chirps to the chirps of dolphins to see if there's any, you know, like that, the peak level that Thomas got with his analysis. You know, I'm looking for patterns. And so I don't have anything to show yet. This week I was sort of pulled away by a family matter, but this coming week I'll have some time to wrap up that and prepare it for next time, and I can share that.
I think John did a fantastic job of doing a preliminary analysis of the chirps. And I think what we'll try to do is obviously incorporate some of those analysis techniques for what we're hoping to receive on the subsequent transmission. So, you know, I think a lot of this is sort of building up to the next transmission and being able to get as much data as possible that we can sort of be going through. And there's only so much that we can do off the initial transmissions. I think that, you know, it's really beginning to lead us down a path, and we're just, you know, trying to refine this approach and you know, sending stuff out with the intent of, you know, trying to get something back. You know, hopefully we can get something that really, really stands out, you know, just like what we were able to identify off of the original transmission.
Well, a question I had was, could it be that we would receive in these signals, we talked about this before, putting it through a television set to see if there's any pictures or moving images included in these signals. And I had this thought of, Martian glyphs, actually. I'm always looking for them on Earth. And I wondered, I just had asked Dennis through the Skype chat window if they had found any glyphs at America's Stonehenge, and I would put that same question to Maria.
What a great question. Okay, Dennis, you answer first, and then Maria.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yes, we have found markings at the museum and the structures, and some of these 30s, but in the 1960s we found more. And Dr. Barry Fell from the Harvard Museum, Harvard University, back in the 1970s, came first to our site 1975, and he did some study on the different markings that were found there. Quite controversial, not accepted by mainstream, but he identified Phoenician, Libyan, and Celtic at our site, according to him. He wrote the book America BC in 1976, you know, the 200th anniversary of the United States. And then he wrote a couple more books after that. He passed away in 1994. But he also looked at markings from from Manana Island in Maine up near Monhegan Island, all the way out to the West Coast and down into Brazil, actually hundreds and hundreds of different types of markings. And again, he found some Phoenician writing and Celtic Ogham and Libyan writing in other places too. So yes, there are markings found at our site.
If your site is dated at like 7,000 years, these are much, much more recent languages.
Oh yes.
So
yes.
we're talking about later cultures who moved in, found them, imprinted their own, kind of like Kilroy was here on these on these stones, but they didn't build them. They're much too ancient to be built by the progenitors of those much more modern languages. And I say modern in the scale of thousands of years.
Right. You know, if you go over to New Orkney Islands, you have Sierra Bray, and I think that's roughly 5,000 years old, I believe. And down the street is Maze Howe. And some of the most remarkable Viking writings or, you know, inscriptions are found at Maze Howe, but they came in maybe 1,000 years ago, but the structure goes back thousands of years before that. So you're exactly right. It was like graffiti put in a later time period. So, but yeah, these markings are found all over North and into South America. And so for hoaxes and frauds and fakes to go out and do all of these, I suppose it's possible. But some of these markings were found back in the 1600s, and people question what they were back then, you know. And it's before some of these writings were interpreted, you know, like Phoenician and Libyan and Celt. They were written correctly, the correct grammar, the correct spelling and everything. And this is going back, you know, hundreds of years ago at different places like the Dighton Rock in Massachusetts, the Bourne Stone, and other stones across the country that were found many, many years before our site was, as far as inscriptions, you know. But it is still controversial, you know. You know, we need more people looking at these. But we do have markings at our site, and no, they need more study, I think. But they might date to around 1800 or 1500 BC, according to Barry Fell. So a later time period, actually.
Maria, what kind of markings, and I don't want to use the very specific term hieroglyphs, which is Egyptian, but what kind of markings or meaningful symbols have been found in and around Stonehenge?
Yes, I'm going to talk about one highly controversial one, and the standard ones, I mean, were dated to 1500 BC, which is very, very late in Stonehenge's long history. You have carvings on the stones of axes and daggers, a very faint carving of a headless person on the inside of one of the stones, but these are much, much later. But when I was doing some research on the glyphs of Stonehenge, there is on one of the trilithons, a very deep rectangular carving. It's rectangular. Now, going back to the 1500s, during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, a scholar went to Stonehenge and said they found a very unusual shape of rectangular metal at Stonehenge, but they didn't know what sort of metal it was. They couldn't figure out if it was tin or lead. They were very confused about that, and they said it had strange hieroglyphs written all over it. And judging by the measurement of what they discovered in the 1500s, it fits perfectly the rectangular carving or indentation on one of the trilithons, and that could have been put there at some time.
It was kind of like a nameplate that was fixed to the stone and then fell out, leaving a rectangular hole?
That's what the scholars in the 1500s said, and they said it was very strange language. Not Ogham. Ogham, which Dennis has mentioned, has, according to Barry Fell, maybe in the British Druid Order, discovered some Ogham there. This isn't Ogham writing. It is a completely different language. And unfortunately, the artifact's gone missing, but they claim, just as you said, it was literally on a stone.
I wonder how they fixed it to the stone.
I know, it's
glue.
A very strange find.
Hmm.
No, if you look carefully at that stone, you can see to this day the indentation there. And they say, archaeologists say it's a later carving dated probably to the same time as the axes and the daggers that are common to Stonehenge. But I think that maybe there's a missing artifact. And
of course,
again,
it's
they all
missing.
Go missing.
Of course, it's missing. Gosh.
It's in that big warehouse with the Ark of the Covenant.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Wow.
Definitely.
Okay, Thomas, I want you to lead us through in a kind of a verbal schematic. And again, we're putting things on the website so people can download this. What is the paper chain between getting a radio, being part of the experiment, recording what you get, and sending it to us? How would you envision that happening in a simplest way possible?
Well, I think first and foremost, I mean, we're going to be putting together just the basic protocol. So what is the frequency to be listening to? Again, there'll be public access to the signal that's going out. And then again, I mean, sort of in the after show, I mean, we'll be sort of discussing how we're going to be, you know, from a technological, you know.
Among ourselves, yes.
Yeah, among ourselves, just sort of, you know, going
well,
over.
Well, let's start with, you know, people can buy this radio that we're using commercially online.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, it's, you know, like at this stage right now, we're broadcasting on frequencies that I think what we're supposing here is that these frequencies have some sort of an effect on the on, let's just call it like the ether. These numbers that we're pulling, you know, we're sort of deriving the transmission frequencies from, these are referenced geometrically in ancient sites all over the world. So again, this is why we've chosen to include sort of different elements of mathematics. But the idea behind what we're trying to do here, and you know, the Baofeng is you know, for its size, it's a powerful ham radio. It's portable. You know, we've got to take into consideration that we're going into some of these sites, and it's not, you know, sort of convenient to be bringing a huge antenna rig and this and that. And what we're also sort of counting on is that based off of the geographical locations and where they're located on the planet, these are, I mean, this is sort of my theory, at least. These are going to be natural amplifiers. They're going to be natural signal amplifiers, both for receiving and for sending outwards. So, you know, again, the important thing is the numbers and the frequencies that we're listening to and that we're broadcasting over. So, you know, all of this information is going to be very clear. It'll be accessible. We'll upload sort of a document before the transmission date. The other thing that we're going to do is put together a little bit of like a time schedule as to when the live experiment is happening. Obviously, we're talking about different time zones. You know, Maria is kind of the tip of the spear here. And she's dealing with a limited amount of time. So we need to kind of go over, okay, where is going to be the first location to send? That's why it's important that the signal that we're sending out is not something that's, you know, 10, 15 minutes long. You know, I think that if we keep this under 5 minutes, we're kind of within that sort of healthy range. So the idea will be to sort of select the starting point, select the starting time. The signal will go, Maria will broadcast the signal outwards, and then we'll go into receiving mode, and then we're going to start listening and see what ends up happening. And then people all over the place are welcome to join in and listen on these frequencies.
And record. Recording
exactly.
is crucial. Crucial.
Exactly.
Everybody has a recording device now. It's called a smartphone.
Exactly. So we want to be recording both acoustically and digitally.
you know, in the previous experiment, David was able to record acoustically. You know, for the analysis, I mean, if we're able to get a digital recording from the source, obviously, you know, this is why we were able to look at some frequencies beyond what the technical limitations of whatever the speaker, you know, that's making sort of the noise is going to have. You know, obviously the Baofengs, you were talking about a small radio, you know, it's going to have a narrow sort of frequency range, which is actually something that we may end up putting into the tone, into the signal that gets broadcast out, is maybe another frequency sweep specifically for these radios, just because at least for our purposes, we've tried to keep the type of radio consistent to be able to sort of, you know, do a good analysis. But, you know, basically what it comes down to is the frequencies and the time that these transmissions are going, and basically, you know, put the signal out there and listen and see what we can get. And the more information that we can get in terms of how people can get the files to us, you know, what Richard was saying is something that I'd mentioned a couple of weeks ago when I was just getting some of the files from the people that have recorded the initial transmissions. Anytime that we're compressing something to an MP3 or compressing something for YouTube or for streaming, you're going to get it's going to degrade parts of the sound frequencies. It's just part of the compression methods. So if you do want to partake in this and listen and do some recording and you get something interesting, you know, that's worthwhile for us to take a look at and analyze, you know, try to keep it in an uncompressed format. So either like an AIFF or a WAV format, in terms of where to be directing that to. I was speaking with Richard. I think we'll probably set up a dedicated email. And, you know, people can either use a service like WeTransfer, you know, or Dropbox or something like that to be able to send it.
Forgive my naive question, but the best format would be like a WAV file?
Well, so an uncompressed audio file. So like a WAV is uncompressed, an AIFF is uncompressed. It really depends on what you're using to record the signals with. So for our purposes, we'll keep that sort of discussion to sort of the after show, just to sort of go over some of of that stuff. But I mean, most people that are out there that have different types of ham radio rigs or other types of hardware to be listening in on some of these on the frequencies that we're sort of playing around with at this point, you know, they'll have different sort of whether they're routing this directly to a computer or to their, you know, to their phone or however. So again, if you don't have the capabilities of being able to record it digitally, which means directly from the radio or from whatever rig you're using to listen in, you know, then acoustic is just as good as well. You know, we're really just trying to get as much data and as much information, and you know, we're trying to apply a bit of the scientific method here. So that's why, you know, this has been something that I've been mentioning in each radio show the last couple of weeks here, is we're trying to open source this. We want to be very transparent with what it is we're trying to transmit, where we're listening to, what some of the logical rationale is behind that. And again, I mean, you know, something that we haven't dived too much into, and maybe that's something that we could do for next week's show leading into the following week, would be really to dive in a little bit as to, you know, where do these frequencies come from? Why are these sacred? Well, there's a mathematical way to be able to identify these frequencies stemming from carvings and symbols in ancient sites, South America and in Egypt. You know, the flower of life is a very big one. And that's, you know, we've found the flower of life in multiple locations around the world. Again, these are sort of two-dimensional representations of the hyperdimensional geometric sort of construct that is starting to sort of take form right now. And that's what we're trying to do. Yes, sorry?
Sorry. Can I toss in a question? Are you going to have a size limit for these?
You mean file
size? You don't want to be getting hour and a half recordings from everybody. Nobody's ever going to be able to go through them.
Well, no, but I mean, I think. Look, we're looking for responses. The responses that came back were kind of within a you know, sort of, let's call it like 1-2 hour kind of time range. And now there's subsequent kind of transmissions that are coming through. It's almost like you're kind of opening up that door and there's, you know, chirps coming in and out at, you know, different times. I think, you know, at the end of the day, if somebody is going to be recording days and days and days and days and days of audio, really what we want to do is, you know, if somebody's going to record an extended recording session, you know, really try to identify sort of points where you receive something anomalous. We want to be concentrating on the stuff that
we don't want to pre-filter. That's the one thing we don't want to do. And we live in an era of computers, because Dave is not going to have to do this manually for much longer. We'll archive everything. If you send us an hour file and we can put some software on it that can look for key frequencies and ratios and constants, we will automate the process. We will not discard your files. We don't want to pre-filter. Ron, I would respectfully disagree. We can archive any amount. Memory is cheap, cheap, cheap. And then we may find gold, because someone in the middle of Iowa may get a specific signal tailored to Iowa and the ancient Native Americans who lived there, as opposed to Stonehenge.
Yeah. So continuing again, like, you know, what the flow of this is going to look like. I mean, what we're trying to do is we're orchestrating a little bit of a production here. So, I mean, Maria.
Yeah, I just didn't want you to get overwhelmed with stuff that was hard to store. You mentioned Dropbox. Every place has limits, so you're going to have to.
I mean, right now,
I'm not trying to limit the amount of information.
Right now the longest sample sizes that we had to work with were actually the recordings that we got from Richard. I mean, those were the largest files that we had to sort of deal with at this point. Again, I mean, once you open up these big files, I mean, you can take a look at this and you know, really visually be able to sort of see where there's stuff that is going to maybe grab your attention. So, I mean, going back to kind of the flow of the experiment, Maria in the last episode last week had sort of started talking about what her actual movement around Stonehenge was going to look like. So what we're going to try to do is basically, based off of her sort of movements and where she's going to be in terms of positions, you know, we want to be able to have some type of a record, you know, so that we know that, okay, well, you broadcast from this location within Stonehenge. And, you know, I think we'll probably be able to get Maria to broadcast this out a couple of different times. And then the interesting thing is going to be that we're going to time this so that towards the last 10, I mean, we really want the initial transmissions to really just be going out from Maria first. So, you know, what we're going to ask of people is that, I mean, if they are going to participate and, you know, and they're going to be listening in, you know, we want really the transmission to be going outwards first with Maria, and then towards the end of her hour within Stonehenge, in that last 10-15 minutes, what we're going to do is we're going to have an overlap. And the idea is going to be that then we'll be able to get the Bosnian group transmitting outwards as well, and then receiving. You know, we can try to do it timed. You know, we'll try to do it with kind of like a time stamp so that you can...
Tom, we're at the bottom of the hour. We will return. My guest this morning, too numerous to mention, they're on the website. You will hear us talking among ourselves as to who is whom. This is most remarkable. Nothing like this has ever, to our knowledge, been done before. We're sending literally the music, the frequencies, the voices of the ancients into the future, into whose ears? That's what we want to find out. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Listen while you travel or as an environment to your endeavors. 8 cents an episode, 2.5 cents per hour of content. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, now Sunday morning here in the Land of Enchantment. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I have a feeling that the name, the Land of Enchantment, is so much deeper and older than the Chamber of Commerce of the State of New Mexico of the United States of America. So I'm going to be recording digitally everything here from even before Maria enters the inner sanctum of Stonehenge itself. And I can't guarantee that we'll get anything, but then again, I can't guarantee that we won't get something absolutely extraordinary, as will other people maybe in the network, because as David and I have discussed on past shows, there is some indication that the messaging to each of these radios is almost tailored to the audience doing the listening or doing the recording. So that morning on February 4th, Maria may get one set of responses, David may get another, Thomas may get a third, Keith a fourth, and Bosnia and Florida and Dennis there in America Stonehenge may get totally different, specifically tailored signals appropriate to where they are listening. Wouldn't that be amazing? How do you talk to an ET? Well, maybe it's even more important to know how to listen. Okay, back to our panel. What have we forgotten? Because we're going to do this after the show session with Maria and with Dennis. If Dennis can stick around, if he hasn't, everything will be in coded form, video, PDFs, all that good stuff. And obviously, you're not going to the moon, so we'd be able to track you wherever you were actually going when you arrived. So what have I forgotten? And don't everybody speak at once.
Well, we forgot the stars because it's possible some of the numbers they're giving us are actually sky-based coordinates rather than Earth. And
You mean like right ascension declination?
Right.
Oh, what an interesting
and
idea.
And what makes me think that is notice that this week I decoded the location for the panorama of the pyramids, and it's exact. I mean, it is right down to the foot to that location on my north latitude. And what is the panorama of the pyramids? It's Orion. I mean, this is from Robert Bovall and Graham Hancock's work that the Giza Plateau and the three pyramids are the map of Orion. So I've been looking at Orion, and I know how to send Orion a signal This was a method I used way before I met Jimmy Blanchette, and that is ratio. So what you have, two or three or more stars in a constellation, I can take the radius of those stars and calculate the ratio between two of them. And that ratio is proprietary. There's no other pair of stars or three stars or more that will have the same ratio of radiuses of the stars. So based on the radiuses, just like the nine ratios we got in Thomas's, you know, interpretation of the data, we can also determine if they're sending us a ratio pattern for a constellation, is what I'm saying. And like, for example, Pleiades has six or seven stars. I think NASA, I mean, not it's astronomy data for Pleiades only has six out of the seven or more stars in that constellation. We have the radius. For example, Sirius A and Sirius B, the radius are very, very accurate. And when you look at Alpha Centauri A and B, the radiuses are really accurate. So your radiuses convert to a ratio, and the ratio pattern is very accurate. So they could be sending us their stellar location as well. It's something I just thought of. And again, what made me think of that is by sending me to the panorama of the pyramids, I'm looking at the ratio of the three pyramids and also their arrangement. You see, what's amazing about arrangement of stars in constellation is the arrangement is proprietary between the observer and the observed. So if I'm on Earth looking at Orion, its arrangement...
It's a unique relationship only seen from Earth.
Exactly.
Okay, John had a very interesting idea. John, you want to ask David?
Yes, David, do you think that they might be sending correlating coordinates that apply to Mars, say, you know, the Giza pyramids, and then the equivalent of that? Because I'm sure that's on Mars.
Yeah, see, those are all ratios and arrangement, geometric ratios, right? So your arrangement, again, it's proprietary between the observer and observed. But the arrangement of the D&M pyramid, you know, Richard did all that stuff years ago on the
leads me back to a question I need to ask Thomas. And Marie, I want to get to your statement in a moment. All right. So, you know, think about it and unmute when you are called. Thomas, can we send images? Can we send graphics? Can we send diagrams? Because what I want to do is to send the geometry of Cydonia, which is the preeminent ancient sacred site on Mars, speaking to the origins of humans. And if we can, I would expect then, John, some of our responses would be in terms of Martian geodetic coordinates tailored to Cydonia and the D&M pyramid or the face as the central meridian.
Agreed.
Well, yeah, so I think, I mean, in terms of sending an image, I mean, I think, again, the beauty of coordinates, the beauty of ratios, I mean, these are sort of more simple mathematical numbers and that can be sent and that we can detect based off of tonal frequencies, right? So, I mean, as soon as we start, you know, trying to encode an image, well, the encoding of the image is going to have to be done based off of some sort of like an algorithm. And then we start getting into the whole thing of, okay, well, if we're sending data, like actual data, you know, are you sending this in binary or, you know, like what is the method of transmission? So I think, you know, at this early stage in the experiment, you know, what we're trying to do is identify intelligence. And that is something, if right now we're going to be retransmitting stuff that we were able to pick up from the first transmissions and the first receipts. And so we're sort of saying, hey, you know, we saw this is kind of interesting. which means, you know, we're taking a look at the actual visual representation of the of these frequencies and sort of identifying these anomalies and then saying, hey, is this something that's being pointed out? So, you know, I think that if that's going to be the case, then, again, expanding on what David was just mentioning, you know, it could be sort of a sequence, sort of saying, okay, hey, take a look at this place right here. And then there's some sort of a way that we can indicate through some type of a mathematical ratio or location that we can encode into the frequencies of Mars and then sort of, you know, kind of break it down into some type of a lat long or however, you know, it's however, you know, Mars has basically been mapped or how you could sort of how you could do that. So, I mean, you know, there isn't some magic sort of way that we're going to be able to, you know, take a picture of something or a map or something quite yet. I mean, the idea right now is to just determine, you know, are we tapping into some type of a network? Are we receiving some type of actual information that has like a logical sort of construct to it? And then, you know, what do we do with this? And then, I mean, the hope is going to be that potentially we can sort of be refining this to a point that maybe they send us back, hey, take a listen to this frequency or, you know, this or that. And that's why, I mean, at this stage right now, the more eyes we have on this, everybody has different pattern recognition.
Yep.
And so that's, so, I mean.
Well, look at how many stunning discoveries have been made by the Citizen Science Network that NASA put together for the Kepler mission and the other one, the space telescope, I'm forgetting.
Exactly.
That were not found by computers, were not found by professionals. They were found by our audience, people like in our audience who bring new insights, new ideas, and tenacity to the problem.
The idea is that we're able to standardize some type of a testing method, that we're open sourcing this so that people can transparently see what our approach is. You know, that this is based off of, this is, we're not just broadcasting some nonsense or something that sounds.
Yeah, I'd like to send meatloaf, but.
Yeah, and I mean, there's nothing, I mean, look at radio signals have been broadcasting everything. I mean, there's all that stuff. This is very targeted. I mean, we're targeting this to specific frequencies. And so, I mean, my hope out of this is that we're able to find more patterns, you know, that are repeatable, that sort of continue to refine our focus of where we're aiming towards. And the best thing is going to be for us to be able to be compiling this evidence to the point where we can involve other people with different types of resources to either analyze what's been received or to assist us in receiving the transmissions. I mean, it's the whole idea of just listening, you know, with what SETI has done for years and years and years, just listening out there, you know.
Listen to this. This is from the scientist that submitted the paper to Project Lyra. This is his previous paper. T. Marshall Eubanks is on Project Lyra. And on the 31st of March, 2021, he submitted with W.P. Blas Radio Luna, a penetrometer deployed network for lunar radio science below 2 megahertz. The radio environment of the moon at low frequencies, particularly in the lunar polar regions and permanently shadowed regions found there, is relatively poorly explored and may contain some novel features. This paper is all about radio moon science. And what did we do before we transmitted to Oumuamua? We did our moon bounce.
Yeah.
And so this is the guy that writes the paper with Bobby Kennedy III's name on it to send a ship to Oumuamua. So this tells me
out of the blue,
science guy. This is so clear that they found out about what we're doing. It's so clear. He's saying that let's see. The current Radio Luna default mission would be an array of 10 to 12 penetrators deployed to the floor of Shackleton Crater in the PSR 4 kilometers below the crater rim, where it would be shielded from all terrestrial, solar, and planetary interference. At the present level of understanding of the low-frequency lunar radio environment, there will be a tight coupling between advances in technology and advances in science, and Radio Luna can be expected to lead improvements in both lunar radio science and lunar communication techniques. So this is the guy, he's a radio guy, who is on the paper that is saying we need to go back to Oumuamua.
So we rang his chimes.
Exactly. Because
Maria, we don't have a lot of time, David, sorry. Maria, you had a very interesting thought. Go ahead.
Yes. In geodetic astrology, heavenly longitude equates to terrestrial longitude. So what the Victorian English astrologers did, they divided the world by having a main meridian line at Greenwich, although I moved that in one suggestion to Stonehenge's main north-south ley line. And then they divided the world up by 30 degrees to get all of the signs of the zodiac in. So you can place a coordinate in the heavens and find its equation down on the ground. So that may have a role at some
point.
Whoa,
that's incredible. So we can double look. We can look at the Earth coordinates they're sending us and pinpoint that same spot to the heavens.
Do you remember, Maria,
yes,
the conversation?
Geodetic astrology.
Remember the conversation you and Georgia had about the Glastonbury Zodiac?
Remind me, Richard.
There is a feature on the limestone plains of England mapping the sky, the Glastonbury Zodiac, which has numerous asterisms, which is a astronomer's way of saying star pattern, star geometry, already an ancient example of exactly what we're talking about, transferring from the sky to a terrestrial grid to look for correspondences between the two.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
That's correct.
Because, again, you go to why would they send me to the panorama of the pyramids? Because you're looking at Orion. So they're showing the Earth-Sky connection, in other words.
Well, do you remember what Jimmy did after he'd finished our test transmission on the night of December 4th, kind of during the show? As the show was ending, he moved the antenna and he sent the same signals to Orion, actually to Sirius, okay?
It was to Sirius, sent it to Sirius.
And then on the low-light television camera, more damn UFOs popped in and out of hyperspace right above his antenna with Orion literally in the field of view and a couple of them dancing around the belt stars of Orion. So I think we're talking to ancestors, family, cousins, whatever, connected to Sirius, the Orion complex, the whole Egyptian mythos surrounding Orion and Isis and Sirius and Set. And of
and
course,
Pleiades, because that's your and, grand gallery.
And the Pleiades, gallery. And of course, the pyramids on the Giza Plateau.
Well, you could be more right than you know, Richard, because we've talked about nonlinear reincarnation before. So it could be us, our future selves, that is, you know, working with our past selves to achieve some goal of disclosure or whatnot. But
I could generate tones for Pleiades, Orion, or Sirius based on their radiuses if we want to send those out. We just have to decide.
I think that's probably a good idea. And I mean, I think that we can kind of move some things around in terms of the length of the signal.
I was going to say, sorry to interrupt, are you talking about that as phase two or part of phase three?
No. I think we can encode some of those into the signal that is going to go out.
How do we encode Mars then? Because part of our hidden history, obviously, is Mars. Look at Jezero. Look at the Giza plateau geometry, both in forward and reverse mirror imaging at the southern part of Jezero.
Absolutely. So I think I think that's what we can work on.
Yeah, you don't want to send everything out all at once, because then when you get your response, you don't know what their response is.
It's like looking for the proverbial damn needle in the damn haystack.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is kind of like a, like the communication that's going to go out is just kind of like a more expanded, like, hello. Right. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that like right now we're pointing at one. I mean, if we're going to point at one site on Earth, like the Great Pyramid, as far as I'm concerned, is the apex of ancient sites at this point in terms of its.
Why don't we say this until
perfection.
Why don't we mm-hmm. say this until Maria is at the Great Pyramid? We do the whole Orion, Sirius, Isis, Pleiades complex. When she's there at the site that mirrors on Earth, that connection. That would make much more sense.
Yeah, Maria, that would be the question to you. What, is there a star coordinate for every one of these sacred sites on the Earth, according to the Vedic astrology? Is that what you said?
According to geodetic astrology, which was done by quite a fascinating astrologer who called himself Sefarel, and he said, yes, in effect, anywhere on Earth, you can find a coordinate above. And there are certain ancient sites that would be. So, for example, you'd look for Stonehenge, for instance, 51 degrees above, and at the moment, that's Draco. So you look for that degree, like 51 on the ground, and then go to the heavens above. And it's interesting what you were saying, David, about Orion, because Orion is into Stonehenge perfectly. In the shape of what's called the station stones, which is the megalithic feature at Stonehenge. So Orion seems to be a really good key constellation for numerous ancient sites across the world.
All right, so I could generate, because the beauty of having three stars is you convert your, based on your radius, you can generate the equivalent to the Schumann resonant math. There's a mathematical formula to calculate the Schumann resonance.
And maybe we should include the Schumann resonance in our signal when we send it.
Yeah, so what we can do...
That's a good idea, because then you say, this, we're from Earth, and then you do the Earth target, you know, tones combined.
If you add too many details at once, even an AI might not be able to recognize.
Yeah, you're right. You don't want to do too many details at once.
I want to remain focused because this is not an end. We don't have an end point. We're going to increase our depth of knowledge. We're going to get answers back. We'll fold those answers into new messages. I really think we ought to focus on what we've decided to do with Maria at Stonehenge and save the whole Isis, Sirius, Orion connection for when she's at Giza.
All right. So what you do now is what Thomas comprised sounds like a really good message to send out for Stonehenge as your number one message, and then save the stars for when she's, you know, at the pyramids.
Yeah, I mean, I think like there's a logical sort of flow to what we're sending. So we're finishing with the coordinates of the Great Pyramid, right? So what I'm hoping for is, again, more responses.
It becomes a teaser for the next iteration.
Exactly.
So Thomas, what
you recorded, you know, Maria needs to get that to put it as a track in her.
Yeah, we're when the show ends,
we'll do that in the after
shortly.
Party. Yeah,
we'll do that in the after party.
Right.
People now just realize we have an after party. Wow!
Oh my God, we gave it away. They're gonna want to know.
They're gonna want to bring the beer and all. Okay. Anyway, again, we got about 5 minutes. What am I missing? What have we not covered? Dennis, have we entranced you enough to carry out this incredibly elegant experiment?
Oh, this has been a really fascinating conversation. Absolutely. You got me on board, and I'm really looking forward to it. I got to find all the details of getting the proper equipment and how to use it and everything. That's what's on my mind right now, trying to stay awake, you know. But, yes, you do. I'm very interested. And, by the way, Orion's belt, you know, the above us, so below, we might have a wall that is aligned with the belt. We'll have to wait.
Oh,
it is a May 1st sunset alignment on the north, and we've known that since the 70s. But I was leaf blowing by just a few days ago, and I'm looking at it, and then I talked to some of my astronomer friends, it's possible that it might represent the belt of Orion. We'll have to check that out.
So Dennis, we've got the lat long of American Stonehenge, right? That's on Google Earth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like 41. Yep. I mean, I take the degrees, minutes, and seconds and convert it to digital, which mm-hmm. is how the numbers are coming in on the radio, because the numbers on the radio are not degrees, minutes, and seconds. They're just, you know, digital degrees.
I think you mean decimal.
Decimal, yeah. That's what I mean.
Okay, so, we can do this in the after party, even though
sure.
you have to split, Dennis, for an airport, right?
Yeah, I got to get going pretty soon.
Yeah, okay,
let me
ask
too.
One more critical Dennis question. Unlike Stonehenge, there are enclosed structures at the America Stonehenge, right?
Absolutely, yeah. These are chambers that you can actually walk into.
Which means you should get
yep.
two radios. One
yep.
radio should be operated in the chambers sequentially to see if the information coming in is different through solid rock.
Hmm, interesting. Yes.
Send somebody to Malta. Sure. If the hypogeum is completely underground.
We have something much closer.
The radio signal will never get through the rock.
That's the idea.
Oh, no, you could. It's a thin covering, but it's the thing's like a cellar.
Because the thing we found, Dennis, is using a radio frequency meter, there is no incoming radio frequency activity on the meter during the radio chirping.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Unless it's operating at a frequency beyond the scope of the meter, which is 6 gigahertz. So if it's higher than that, the meter wouldn't see it. But we don't know that yet because we haven't
right.
tested higher than 6 gigahertz.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, let's see how that works then.
Well, the thing I'm thinking of is that granite quartz embedded in, you know, lithically melted rock is the perfect hyperdimensional torsion field detector based on my Accutron measurements, which means if you go in one of these chambers and there's no way radio can penetrate and you can test that, you may get a signal on this radio because they're not using RF frequencies. They're literally tickling the torsion field, and that's how they make the radio and its circuitry respond in a way that mimics radio, but it's not really what we think of as radio.
That's what I think is happening.
I think that's what I think is happening as well.
Well, the fact that I'm getting such weird things happening here, nothing's predictable, nothing is scientific, nothing can be extrapolated from today to yesterday to tomorrow, tells me that there's unknown quantities that I've got to figure out because somebody at the other end of the phone is kind of playing head games. Okay, Hoagland, figure this out. And on that note, we are literally, guys, out of time. I want to thank all my panelists. I'm not going to list you because I'll forget somebody. Stick around if you can. Dennis, happy voyaging. We will pick you up on the other side. And I must thank everyone for a splendid evening. We're going to do this tomorrow night, same time, same bat channel, because we're going to rebroadcast tonight's show, which basically is a outline of how do you talk to an alien. Except in this case, I'm not quite sure we're talking to aliens. I have a feeling we're talking to us. As John says, maybe an ancient or a future version of us. Because, I mean, really, who else would care as much as somebody seems to be sending us the critical information from us? So until tomorrow night, when we'll pick this up exactly the same, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.